You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 143 by Rudolf Steiner, 14 lectures entitled Three Paths to Christ, Experiencing the Supersensible, translated by Christiana Bryan. This is Lecture 7, given in Stockholm on the 16th of April, 1912, entitled Three Soul Paths to Christ, in two parts. First part, The Path via the Gospels, and The Path of Inner Experience. Over the next two more intimate evenings, we will talk about a question concerning humanity, which in a twofold manner impacts our souls quite extraordinarily deeply. Firstly, the enigma of Christ has occupied countless souls across the earth over the past 2,000 years, and also because it has flowed into innumerable earthly souls as their spiritual lifeblood, their strength of soul, comfort and hope in their suffering, as fortitude and certainty in their actions. Not only this, but if we take into account everything surrounding us by way of external culture, created over many centuries, then on deeper consideration, we see that all this would have been impossible had Christ's impetus not gripped a large swath of humanity. This is one thought which shows with what strong interest the question of Christ must take hold of us if we are to approach it with anthroposophical knowledge. This is just one aspect of the attention we bring to this enigma. The other originates specifically in the soul and spiritual conditions of our time, of our epoch. We need only look around in the world, hoping to understand the yearning, the questing of human souls, and we will reflect. Ever increasingly do human souls search for what has been connected with the name of Christ among souls over the centuries. Ever more do souls become convinced that renewing the pathways, renewing interest, deepening our knowledge are essential if the needs of human souls, as they increase ever more in relation to Christ, are to be satisfied. Though we find on the one hand a craving to discover Christ, on the other we find in many souls of the present some hesitation and uncertainty as regards the means so far employed. Hence, one of the most burning issues of today is that of finding an answer to this longing, and in relation to the uncertainty, experiencing the truth. It is therefore obviously the task of a spiritual movement, which enters further into spiritual foundations, to create some clarity around such queries. If matters appear like this at present, they will, in a relatively short time, in fact in a very short time, look completely different. If we look somewhat unselfishly at what our descendants will need in future in relation to Christ, we will have to admit, even if multitudes of people nowadays derive fulfillment from what already exists, more and more souls will feel uncertain, longing for answers. When we speak about Christ today, we are speaking about what we foresee will be essential for people of a very imminent future. Anthroposophy would not be fulfilling its task were it not to place itself where it could create clarity on these issues, insofar as this is possible today, through its findings. My point of departure will be to show three ways in which, over the course of human evolution, souls can reach the Christ. When speaking of three paths, I have to mention briefly that one of those paths no longer exists, though it did earlier for millions of people over the centuries. Yet today, it cannot be an esoteric path in the way that anthroposophy can be, particularly for our times. This first path is via the Christian records, the Gospels. This was the route for millions upon millions of people and continues to be the only option for them. The second way for human souls to seek the Christ is what we can call the path of inner experience, which countless souls in the present and in the near future will have to tread due to their particular configuration and their unique characteristics. The third pathway is one which can at least begin to be understood nowadays and which emanates from the anthroposophical movement, the path of initiation. So, there are three approaches to Christ. Firstly, via the Gospels, secondly, through inner experience, and thirdly, through initiation. The first path via the Gospels only needs outlining here. We all know that the Gospels have, over the centuries, nourished the hearts and souls of countless people. We also know that the most enlightened, the most critical of natures, and these are not the non-religious, are starting to lose their connection with this path under the prevailing view that external knowledge cannot be sure which realities actually stand behind the historical events described in the Gospels. Had people of previous centuries read the Gospels in the same way as today's academic reads them, having undergone a modern scientific education, they would not have had the vast life-changing effects they have exerted. If they were not read in this intellectual way in past centuries, how were they in fact read? What took place in Palestine at the beginning of our calculated era would not have been at the forefront of consideration by a gospel reader of earlier centuries, and this is still the case for many reading the Bible. Those who start trying to align what took place in full view of the people of Palestine, at the start of our calculated era, with what appears in the Gospels, are sent mad by the historical nature of events in Palestine. Earlier readers did not read them in this way. They would read them by allowing pictures, such as the Samaritan at the well, or Christ preaching to his disciples on the mountain, to sink into their souls. Questioning the external, physical reality of events was not their prime concern. The central focus for them was the way in which their hearts lifted and their feelings were moved by such vast and mighty pictures, and further what took shape in their hearts, how they were granted strength and a sense of purpose in their lives. They felt that spiritual life blood and strength flowed to them from these pictures. When they allowed such images to affect their souls, they felt strong. They sensed that they would be weak without them. Then they would feel a lively personal bond with what was recounted in the Gospels, and questions as to its historical accuracy would not further concern them. The Gospels themselves constituted reality. They existed as a power, and questions as to whence they originated were of no interest. They knew that people had not written them by earthly means, but through stimuli from the spiritual world. I am not claiming that one should also feel like this nowadays. What one has to do depends on human evolution. I am just saying that people felt in this way over past centuries. How could it be like this? Only now can spiritual science tell us. If we start understanding the Gospels through spiritual science, and try to make our way into what has flowed into them from spiritual worlds, is contained within them, we face the Gospels, saying, independently of these Gospels, we learn from spiritual scientific sources what took place in the evolution of humankind as the Christ impetus, and thus we find what is contained in the Gospels independently of them. How can we conceive of the Gospels spiritual scientifically? If I may make a simple comparison, I'd say, imagine someone had clarified something to themselves. They encounter a second person with their elucidation and start a conversation. The first person doesn't initially want to assume that the second person knows about their enlightenment, but during their conversation they notice that the second person knows as well as they do what the issue is. What can be sensibly deduced? It is sensible to assume that the second person acquired their lucidity from the same or from similar sources. It is just like this with the Gospels, and we can do likewise, depending on the perspective from which we approach them. An association of people who read the Gospels in the way described could be formed, one which included opponents of the Gospels who claim, if we check these Gospels within the context of external scientific methods, we find that they were written far later than the events they describe could have taken place in Palestine. Accounts contradict each other. In short, these Gospels cannot be seen as historical documents. People of such a persuasion could exist in an association of this sort, yet one could say, leaving the Gospels in peace for now, let's research into spiritual worlds. If we carry out truthful spiritual research, we will reap true supra-sensory knowledge. We would be able to ascertain that a mighty impetus from out of the spiritual world entered into human evolution and exerted an immense influence on the development of humankind. Then we would see that this impetus took powerful hold of an individual who was particularly suited to this task at the beginning of our calculated era. We would then be in possession of this, and much else by way of related knowledge, which can only be gained through spiritual research. Then those not wanting to have anything to do with the Gospels could still access what the others have. Then we could approach the Gospels and say, fine, we have so far not bothered about these Gospels. It's amazing that when we read them carefully, we see that they contain what we find independently of them in spiritual scientific spheres. Now, we appreciate their worth from a different perspective, and we can be certain that their source can be none other than the very source the writers of the Gospels drew upon, but revealed for humanity through this spiritual movement. This is exactly where we stand as we face what will increasingly come to pass, and which will justify every reverence for the Gospel documents. That being so, we will have to state that people will be able to find, via other means, what can be learned from these manuscripts. In this way does such knowledge start to become ever more holy for us, through today's spiritual understanding. It already used to affect people through the power of the Gospels. It is because the Gospels are so thoroughly saturated with the most sacred wisdom, the most spiritual motivating force of humanity, that they also moved those who accepted them naively. Spiritual impulses do not just work abstractly, theoretically, but where they exist, they work as life forces and life blood for human souls. Ever increasingly will it be recognized how comfort, strength, and certitude will flow from such spiritual findings. However, when we speak of an inner path to Christ, we will encounter ever more content there that can at present only be understood and felt when approached with the correct spiritual scientific understanding. An attempt will be made to speak of the inner Christ experience in such a way that it will be possible to see how it can arise in any person, quite regardless of the means of transmission. For this, we will, admittedly, have to view the human being with the knowledge we have garnered from spiritual science. Immersing ourselves in such knowledge, we find that even the most basic grasp of this approach will bear fruit when applied to life. It shows how we can transcend schematic abstraction beyond the seven constituent elements of the human being when we focus on the genesis and evolving of humankind. The human physical body undergoes its particular development in the first 7 years of life. We also noted that during the second 7-year phase, between the change of teeth and reproductive maturity, the forces of the etheric body are chiefly active. Thereafter, astral forces come to the fore, and only around 20 or 21, depending on the overall deployment of forces within the organism, does what manifests as the I, capital, arise with the forces it maintains throughout its life as bearer of the human ego. Actually, it is barely noticed nowadays how the bearer of a human I only becomes fully viable around age 20 or 21, because the present is not inclined to pay attention to things of this nature. What does it in fact signify? That the ego only becomes properly active around the age of 20 or 21. We need to observe the evolving human being and their deeper organizational forces by spiritual means. These forces are in perpetual change, from birth to seven, from seven to sexual maturity, from reproductive maturity to I evolution. They change in a way that cannot be tested by conventional physiology or anatomy. They can, however, be recognized very well by spiritual means, and one can confirm that around the age of 20, human beings evolve such powers that a complete entity suited to itself as a bearer of an I is present. Before this, it is not fully formed as the bearer of an I. Human physicality being, also at a supra-sensory level, no proper carrier for an ego. So, when we observe the constituent elements of human beings in terms of great world principles, we would need to say, human beings are only capable, through the uniqueness of their organisms, of their I evolving to fully matured form from out of itself at around age 20, and no earlier. We can contrast this fact with another, namely that in our first years and with normal consciousness, we practically dream or sleep our way into life, and only from a distinct point onward do we start to have our own memories. Our parents or older siblings tell us everything before that point. From then onward, we say to our inner selves, I am the one I am. From then on, when we say, I did this, I thought that, do we identify our I within our souls? What went before is lost to soul gloaming. Our memory only reaches as far back as the point described. With what are we presented when we juxtapose both these facts? Firstly, that the actual bearer of the human I is only born around the age of 20 or 21. And secondly, that our souls only designate us as an I from around age 3 or so. This is so because in the present phase of their evolution, human beings have an opinion or a feeling about themselves that does not correspond with their inner configuration, such as it has become. An awareness of an I sets in around age 3 or 4, while the constitutional support for an I only appears around age 20 or 21. This discrepancy is of fundamental importance for an understanding of human beings. If you present this fact abstractly as spiritual knowledge, nobody will be particularly excited. But because this fact is true, countless well-known experiences are available, which are still not viewed in light of this fact. Everything humans experience as the dichotomy or discrepancy between external organism and inner experience, in life's suffering and pain as a result of certain things not being possible due to their constitutions, in the disharmony between what they wish or want and what they can actually achieve, the fact that they can have ideals that are beyond their capabilities to fulfill, all this leads back to the reality that the consciousness of our I takes a path quite different from the bearer of that I. We are twofold beings in the respect that we are organized as external entities whose ego nature matures around 20 or 21, and an inner being of soul whose inner soul existence is already freed from its external constituents from around the age of 4 or 5. This emancipation of ego consciousness from its external components takes place during childhood. We undergo something in our souls which takes place independently of our outer elements and which can actually come into harsh conflict with those outer components. As regards inner consciousness of our I, we tend to ignore our constitution and what exists down in our bodies. We evolve in soul quite differently from the way in which our bodies develop. The course of inner human evolution is therefore twofold. The course of our development goes from our first to our seventh year, then from 7 to 14, from 14 to 21, as has been described. The course of inner development is quite independent of this. In that consciousness of our I is freed from earliest childhood onward, making its own way independently through life. What are the consequences of this unique fact of human evolution? Only a spiritual scientist will be able to tell you that. If we bear in mind all that spiritual research can teach us, we arrive at an extraordinary insight, namely that illness, organic human frailty, everything constituting sickliness, age, and death alone make possible and are results of the fact that we are actually a dichotomy. We die because in a certain sense we are constituted not to take account of the evolution of our I. We are reminded of the fact that our ego consciousness takes a self-dependent route that is concerned with our organism only when that organism sets itself up as a hostile hindrance to that ego's development during illness, infirmity, and death. Then we are reminded that our I progresses, quite sundered from our bodies. Where does this strange twofold human nature originate? If we look at the human being and all this in their true context, we are shown that had only progressive forces intervened in human evolution at a certain point in Earth evolution, namely during the Lemurian epoch, childhood and youth would now proceed quite differently. They and the development of the I would remain in step with each other. Soul and body would develop in exact congruence. It would then have been impossible for human beings to grow up differently from the ideal, as represented, for instance, in my book titled The Education of the Child in the Light of Spiritual Science. Had only progressive forces been active then, the curious circumstance would have pertained that for their first 21 years, humans would have been far less self-reliant than they are presently. This lack of self-reliance is not meant in any negative sense. The state of dependence is meant in a sense with which you would all agree. It is human nature to rely purely on imitation in the first 7 years of life. Had only benevolent forces been active in ancient Lemuria, grown-up people would not have done anything shameful, and children between birth and seven would not have been able to imitate anything disreputable. In the second seven-year phase, the principle of authority would have held sway, whereas now it is not only a national, but a world scourge that young people aged between 7 and 14 want to be, and are even brought up to be, independent and to have autonomous opinions. Adults would naturally have been the obvious authority for children. Between 14 and 21, young people would have been far less introspective, focusing more on externals than on themselves. The power of ideals, the strength to live life's dreams, would have become immensely meaningful to them. These dreams would have burgeoned from their hearts, and then full self-consciousness would have dawned at age 20 or 21. So one would have had an age of imitation from birth to seven, in the second seven-year phase a deference to authority, and in the third phase the heartfelt burgeoning forth of ideals, which would lead people to full I self-consciousness around age 21. A certain segment of powers deviated from this course over evolutionary ages, thwarting its progress, and these we call luciferic powers. Since Lemurian times, they have been tearing human I consciousness adrift from its foundation in our bodies. That we are conscious of our ego in our earliest years is attributable to luciferic powers. How did luciferic powers intervene? These luciferic powers are beings who remained behind on the moon, and who, for this reason, have no sense of the Earth's mission, nor for what should have evolved on Earth from age 21 onward, the human I. They took humans to be just as they had been when they transmigrated from the moon and planted the seeds of self-sufficiency into their soul's development. Thus, behind the prematurity of ego consciousness, that idiosyncratic dichotomy in human nature, lie luciferic forces. Only now can anthroposophy enable us to recognize this fact. Anyone who is in tune with their nature can feel it, because anyone can feel that they contain something that separates them from their full humanity. Everything we can call unjustifiable egotism in our natures, all insularity from the true activity of humanity, derives from the fact that our eye does not follow its true course in accompanying our bodies. This is how the human being presently appears to us. When we are capable of feeling, I could be different from the way I am, I contain an element which disagrees with me, when we feel this, we become aware of the antagonistic conflict of progressive powers against luciferic powers within ourselves. This reality had to be created over the course of human evolution. It was necessary because otherwise, and without those luciferic powers, humans would never have become truly free, and would have remained forever bound to their bodies. The very thing that causes human beings to diverge into dichotomy, on the one hand, offers them, on the other, the potential to be free. Yet one thing is lacking from this dual constitution in a normal life. As evidence for this, we sense that our I has become impoverished, unable of its own accord to transform our bodies. If we survey in a wider context all that constitutes the human being, two forces are described: the organic forces of our human nature, which are intended to develop up to 7 years, and on the other side, luciferic forces. Were there nothing more in the course of human evolution than nature and spiritual life, human beings could never create any harmony between their emancipated egos and their own natures. Were nothing further generated from the furthest reaches of earth existence, then that evolution could only result in human beings becoming ever more alienated from their bodies, their constitutions becoming ever sicklier, ever more desiccated, and the dichotomy necessarily growing ever wider. If only people could manage to really feel this as an instance of spiritual scientific knowledge, a momentous point would be reached in which they said, "Here I am with my human disposition, which has been given to me by progressive spiritual beings working in 7-year cycles." They wouldn't need to say this in actual words, just feel it. "But because my bodily nature contains a counterforce that evolves independently, it sickens, gets old, and eventually dies." Human beings feel this in the depths of their souls, and only need to sense the discrepancy between their inner eye and their external features. If they can live in this feeling without even knowing anything about anthroposophy, then yes. From whence? They don't at first know from whence. Something enters their soul that prompts them to feel, "I myself, with my eye, that eye toward which I can think back, I can do nothing much to counteract my constitution, because I have not grown into it. Yet there is something I can absorb into my consciousness as a conviction. Directly from out of the spiritual world, something approaches that is not inherent in me, but which permeates my soul. Something from unknown worlds is able to flow into my soul. If I accept it into my heart, if I suffuse my eye with it, then it can help me directly from spiritual worlds. Call it what you will, it makes no difference. It just depends on the perception or feeling." Let's take someone who was not coping well in life. They might say to themselves, "I need to look far and wide throughout the world for a force that will enable me to overcome the duality within me." It is in the nature of things that people no longer turn to the old religious denominations. nor can they connect with outmoded ecclesiastical concepts, which cannot provide them with the strength they seek. Let's say, to take a concrete example, that a person were to turn to one of the ancient holy religions, such as Buddhism, and would immerse themselves in its extraordinary teachings. If such a person naturally experienced in all its force the dichotomy described, I am not saying due to some theory, but with an indistinct feeling, they would sense that in the personality, in the individuality of Gautama Buddha, there lived something which could only exist on the basis of a lengthy evolution. This individual had undergone many incarnations, reaching ever higher and loftier levels of development, until finally, at the age of 29, he rose from Bodhisattva to Buddha, and as such had no further need to return to a physical body. How did what flowed from this individual come about? Anyone with an open mind can feel what issues from the Buddha, what grew for the first time in earth evolution in the Bodhisattva, what evolved over many incarnations. All this contains, in the most beautiful, sublime sense, forces to be found in the periphery of the earth, in the interplay between constitutional and luciferic forces. Because they persisted from incarnation to incarnation, the forces flowing from Bodhisattva to Buddha, stemming as they do from the same source as those of humanity, they have the effect that the unbiased soul does not feel the full harmony that can be brought about between the human eye and its attendant body. The soul feels that something must exist which does not persist from incarnation to incarnation, but which flows directly into each human soul from spiritual worlds. When the human soul feels that it must have a direct relationship with what streams downward from spiritual worlds, then it begins to have an inner experience of Christ. Then it comprehends that in Christ Jesus something had to arise that was quite different from everything that had gone before. That is the fundamental and radical difference between the life of Christ and that of Buddha. Buddha evolved from Bodhisattva to Buddha, with the forces that allow human beings to advance from one incarnation to another. Just as in the case with all the great founders of religions, in the life of Jesus of Nazareth, something was working directly from the spiritual world into the individuality of Jesus of Nazareth over 3 years, something that had nothing to do with human evolution, and which had never previously been connected with a human life. This is a difference we need to make quite clear to our souls if we want to grasp why in the fourth post-Atlantean epoch, which named him Christ, something existed which was completely different from all the other religious impulses, and why those other religions had always directed humanity toward this Christ. If we look back over post-Atlantean ages to the hallowed ancient culture of India, we see the emergence of the seven holy rishis, whose souls encompassed elements of direct vision into spiritual worlds. Had one asked one of the seven holy rishis about the underlying mood of their soul, they would have answered, "We gaze aloft to spiritual powers, from whom all human evolution has issued forth." This reveals itself to us in seven rays, but above this is something far more exalted than our sphere. Later, they called what the seven holy rishis experienced Vishvakarman, and they were speaking of a power which had not evolved with the earth. This was followed by the culture of Zarathustra. When Zarathustra directed his gaze toward the spirits of the sun, he spoke of an element which would flow into human evolution by streaming out of spiritual worlds. Zarathustra said, "What we can grant humanity is not what will one day stream from far spiritual realms of the sun." The spiritual element in the sun was the being whom later Persian culture called Ahura Mazda. As a result of a particularly tragic impact, did the Egyptian mysteries experience the question of Christ. It was experienced in the deepest possible way, if by deepest we understand a form of human perception, that inscribes into the soul a consciousness that humanity stems from what is spiritual. An Egyptian initiate would say, "Wherever we turn our gaze, we experience in what surrounds us a fall from our spiritual origins. Nowhere can we find direct, unalloyed spirituality in our physical surroundings. Only when human beings go through the gate of death will they encounter the realm of their origins. One first has to die, as regards inner experience, not as regards initiation, in order to be united with the Osiris principle, as the ancient Egyptians called the Christ principle. This does not happen in life, where the mismatch of duality reigns. Nothing within the compass of earth leads to Osiris. A soul has to be beyond the gate of death to be united with Osiris. In death, the soul will become a part of Osiris, will itself become a sort of Osiris. The outer world has become such that his enemy has dismembered Osiris. In other words, everything belonging to the outer world has carved him up. An initiate of the Egyptian mysteries would have said, "The human beings of our present culture are a sort of recollection from ancient moon existence. Just as the humanity of the seven holy rishis is like a memory of ancient Saturn existence, and Zarathustrian culture reminds us of ancient sun existence, so does Osiris culture remind us of ancient moon evolution, when the moon and all its attendant beings first separated from the sun, on which, however, those beings remained from whom humanity originates. This is where humans were separated from the benevolent forces of their constitution, from the fount of their life forces. But the time will come, through all that humanity will have suffered by way of longing for and privation of a spiritual dimension, when Osiris will descend and will manifest as the fresh stimulus that is bound to appear, one which has not previously existed on earth because it had already separated from earth during ancient moon existence. Everything referred to by the seven holy rishis and Zarathustra, and which the Egyptians believed the people of their times could never, during their lifetimes, attain, this was the force, the incisive impetus, which for 3 years manifested in the body of Jesus of Nazareth. All the great religions spoke of him, and he was revealed in Jesus of Nazareth, the being whom all religions had presaged. Thus not only did Christians speak of Christ, but so did the believers of all the old religions. In this way, an element entered over the course of human evolution, of which human beings had great need, and which can be reached through inner experience. Suppose that someone grew up on a remote island. They were told nothing of what was going on in the rest of the world as regards the name of Christ, nor about the Gospels, but only told about prevailing local culture, without mention of Christ or the Gospels. What had developed in their culture under the influence of Christ, but now divested of Christ's name, was introduced to this person. What would happen? The following mood would have to arise. One day they would muse, "I have within me something that is in harmony with my entire human makeup, but I cannot at the moment access it. For the place in which my ego consciousness exists appears to me to be lacking something, something which I cannot receive through human culture, some impetus from the spiritual world, which will once more strengthen my I in my constitution, from which it has become detached." If such a person were to feel strongly enough what humans need, something would come over them, enabling them to recognize something had to stream directly from the spiritual world and wholly settle within my eye. They do not know that the name of this is Christ, but they know that they can infuse their consciousness with it, that they can cherish in their eye what flows to them from the spiritual worlds. Then a sense would come over them of which they could say, "Well, I may be ill, I may be weak, I could die, but I can strengthen my I by my own efforts. I can send something into my constitution which will make me stronger, which will give me strength directly from the spiritual world. What they call it is of no consequence. If a person arrives at this feeling, they are suffused with the force of Christ. It is not the person who claims that they can expect to gain from a teacher who has undergone incarnation after incarnation, but the person who senses in their feelings that waves of power, of strength, can come directly from spiritual worlds. This is the person who is seized by Christ's impetus. Human beings can have this inner experience. Without it, they cannot live. Without it, human beings of the future will not be able to live. They can have this experience because for 3 years this impetus, issuing directly from spiritual worlds, lived objectively within Jesus of Nazareth. As truly as one can plant a seed in the earth and from it many other seeds will issue, just as truly was Christ's impulse laid into humankind. Since that time, something exists within humanity that did not previously exist. It is for this reason that Egyptian life is so tragic. It was felt that during one's lifetime, one would be unable to reach Osiris, that one would have to go through the portal of death in order to be reunited with Osiris. This applies only to inner experience and not to initiation, which we will speak of later. However, since the time of the mystery of Golgotha, what was previously impossible is now possible for human beings, of their own accord and on the basis of their unique incarnation, to seek a connection with the spiritual world. This has come about because the impetus that was given by the mystery of Golgotha can light up within every soul, and since that time can inhabit every human being through their inner experience. Not the Christ who walked on earth. The soul is not connected with this figure, but the Christ who is attainable through inner experience. Since the mystery of Golgotha, it is possible within a single individual incarnation to gain a union with what is spiritual. And because this is so, something took place with that single deed of Golgotha which can radiate throughout humanity, which is not granted through the achievements of succeeding incarnations. For this reason, it is not possible for Christ to manifest in a way that is the result of many incarnations, in the same way as Buddha emerged from his incarnations as a bodhisattva. Tomorrow we shall see how, for the future, the path to Christ can be found amid human evolution. The end of Lecture 7.